Social inequality has an environmental dimension, and that's really the topic of my presentation. I want to talk about the theory and science and the policy implications of this environmental dimension. So we know from going back hundreds of years that in literature and art, and then back to the beginnings of public health as it is today, that socioeconomic disadvantage has typically been confined or resigned to specific environments, particular kinds of environments. And that kind of environmental segregation was really described and documented in color-coded detail in the 19th century by Charles Booth in these kinds of interesting maps that you can look up. It's kind of the forerunner to modern GIS. In Britain in the 19th and 20th century, these kinds of environments were essentially in cities where people were crowded into poorly built homes and living in dangerous and unsanitary neighborhoods. And the notion that our neighborhoods and our home environments shape our habits and our health is today enshrined in key public health concepts and principles. And for example, this social ecological model from Dahlgren and Whitehead that really captures the importance of the environmental conditions as a distal determinant of health. But just as disease burdens in rich countries like ours has shifted from infectious diseases and diseases of malnutrition to chronic diseases, so too has our thinking about how environments can shape health. So if we think about this from the perspective of the history, so we've faced really high rates of problems due to unsanitary conditions like cholera, rickets, and today really what we're talking about is obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. So that's a shift in the frame, but I don't think that I think we shouldn't lose sight of the role of environments on these as a determinant of these conditions. So these conditions. Modern public health problems are not shared equally in society. So data from the Health Survey for England, for example, shows stark gradients in obesity rates by income and by education. And this is showing data from for men and women from the Health Survey for England.
I'm sorry, Pamela, do you know that there are no slides?
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Unless I'm not blind.
No, I apologize. So what's the secret here? How do you get this thing to... Is that working? Ah, sorry. Okay, there we go. I really wanted to show you. So there's Charles Booth. I totally apologize about that. So. Yeah. These are that was actually my excuse for doing this. Going back into the archives here. So we've got these really document kind of the social segregation of socioeconomic status, but. And this is kind of what things look like in the 19th and 20th century, and this is the social ecological model I mentioned. But the point being that these conditions really are not these problems that we have today of chronic disease and obesity are not shared equally in society, and that's really the point of these slides here that show the social inequality in rates of obesity. This is data from the Health Survey for England, and then as well. Showing socioeconomic differences in chronic disease, which in this case is diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And you can see these are just different levels of income and showing data estimates for men and women in England. So these conditions and the inequalities in these conditions are mirrored by differences in diet. So again, looking at data from Health Survey for England, you can see that there are sharp social gradients in the consumption of healthy foods like fruits and vegetables. This is estimates of the percentage of the population achieving fruit and vegetable targets. And then there's also less information about other foods that are less healthy, for example, sugars and red and processed meat. But one of the PhD students in my group, Eva McGuire, has done some analysis of the flagship survey of diet in the UK, which is NDNS. And she's found that, for example, there's a 30% difference in the intake of added sugars in the diet by income. and also a similar gradient in the consumption of red and processed meat. And again, these are foods that we all need to be eating less of, but they reveal social patterning in their intake. So I've shown you that we've got these today, these inequalities in chronic disease risk and obesity, as well as inequalities in diet. So if we think about this from a causal kind of framework, you can see this very simple idea that low socioeconomic position is associated with obesity and chronic disease risk, and some of that we can attribute to unhealthy behaviors. However, we know that unhealthy behaviors are driven by a number of factors, and what my proposition is today is that environments are particularly important for that. So unhealthy environments, broadly defined as environments that are not supportive of healthy habits, and in fact are facilitating unhealthy habits. So I will unpack that in just a moment, but how can we identify unhealthy environments, particularly around things related to diet? Well, in particular, and this extra arrow here is to capture the idea that your socioeconomic position is not entirely driving your disease risk through environments and behaviors. There are other pathways as well. So how do we characterize unhealthy environments? Well, I'll get to that in a moment, but let me just first say that this idea that environments are a key mediator of the social inequality in health was articulated about 10 years ago in this nice paper by Jamie Pierce, where he'd framed it in terms of deprivation. And he said, deprived neighborhoods are essentially deprived in a number of dimensions, in particular, the physical characteristics of neighborhoods, but also the social and community aspects of neighborhood life. But these physical characteristics could influence a number of pathways, some of these being behaviors, including diet. So if we come back to our idea and frame it specifically around diet and obesity and chronic disease risk, we can define this as an unhealthy food environment more specifically. And one way to identify unhealthy food environments is to kind of look at what Public Health England has identified as an important environmental risk factor, which are takeaway food outlets and fast food outlets. And this very nice report from them from a couple of years ago showed the spatial patterning of food outlets in England. This is showing the density of takeaway food outlets across England. But more importantly, I think, was this very impressive scatter plot that showed that more deprived areas here had higher densities of these takeaway food outlets, about threefold difference from the most deprived to the least deprived local authorities in England. So that really confirms this idea that people of lower socioeconomic position disproportionately face these unhealthy environments. But how did we get here? This is data from about 3 or 4 years ago. There really is very little historic information, but again, one of my PhD students, Eva McGuire, went back in time. She got a time machine. It was a very hard project to do. And she looked at food environments in the county of Norfolk, just up the road, over the last 18 years, specifically from 1990 to 2008. And actually, many of you might have seen a poster on this just during the lunch break. So she tracked the evolution of the food environment. This is just the number of fast food outlets adjusted for the population over time. And she found about a 40% increase in the rise of takeaways in Norfolk during that period. These are data for about 200 census wards in that county. But when she broke those 200 census wards up by deprivation, she found something actually much more dramatic. She found that actually the bulk of the rise in the number of takeaways was really happening in the most deprived parts of the county. And so, again, that really emphasizes this idea that environments are not really equal for all of us. And many of us, people who are living who live in socioeconomically deprived areas or are of low socioeconomic status themselves, might face unhealthy food environments. But what does this mean? So if we've established that people of lower socioeconomic position face unhealthy food environments, you can kind of graphically represent it this way. For this to follow through, you really need to link it to diet. So is unhealthy food environment systematically related to diet? There is a very big and messy and actually equivocal evidence base. So we conducted our own study based on a very rich resource here. But the hypothesis was really this, that people who faced higher numbers of takeaways would tend to have unhealthy diets and more likely to be obese. So kind of a straightforward idea, very somewhat naive actually, but that was the idea. And so to do this, we worked with a local cohort here in the east of England, the Fenland cohort, which is very rich and has information about where people live, where people work. And then from that data, we can also reconstruct how they travel to and from work. And then using data from local authorities, we can reconstruct objective information about their environment. And so these dots represent fast food outlets. And we can really measure the overall exposure that people have over the course of their day to these food environments. And then we can rank people based on this level of exposure in a sort of classic epidemiological way. And the upshot is that people who are more exposed to fast food outlets, in this case, we break them into four groups, with Q4 being the most exposed, or systematically consuming more fast food. This is in grams per day per person. And then this is also, we found that people who are more exposed are more likely to be overweight. These are BMI units, 1.2 BMI units, and more likely to be obese. And this, you know, standard epidemiological approach, we can do our best to control for a number of confounding factors. I'm not going to get into it. But that was the upshot of this study. And we found that the unhealthy food environment was linked to unhealthy diet. But the key question for us to follow up was, given what we know about socioeconomic position, is it the same for everyone? In particular, is the influence of the food environment the same for people of lower socioeconomic position as higher socioeconomic position? This diagram already gives the story away that we didn't think it would be. Particularly, we thought that people of higher socioeconomic position might be more immune from the local environment or less susceptible to it, depending on how you want to frame it. So that's the study we did in follow-up. And again, I kind of reiterate our dietary results here, which show you that between the bottom and the top, there was about a 6-gram difference, or about 18% difference in takeaway food consumption. That's about a serving of fries a week when you add it up. But if you now look at how these exposures differ by people who have attained different degrees of education, you see very different results. And in particular, we see inequality in the consumption of fast food, even at every level of food exposure. So, and what becomes remarkable is that the gap between the most educated, which is the lowest bar, and the least educated becomes bigger at higher levels of education, at higher levels of fast food exposure. And then when you combine these exposures, in a sense, people who are most advantaged in that they've got education and have little exposure, compared to people who have little education but a lot of exposure, that gap in unhealthy food consumption becomes much more profound. So there's already policy action on this. About 3 or 4 years ago, Greater London Authority issued a report to provide guidance to local authorities to use existing planning laws to take action on stemming the proliferation of fast food outlets in the area to promote public health. And there's a recent example. Birmingham has had such a SPD, a supplementary planning document, on the books that is designed to curtail planning approval in areas where food outlets are already very high, these fast food outlets. And I don't have more up-to-date information about this, but you can see that as of about a year and a half ago, that this extra regulation has now resulted in the rejection of about half of the applications for new fast food outlets. But the problem here is that we don't really know what this is doing for public health. There's been no evaluation of this. But the problem is that these local actions in public policy are not necessarily being framed in a systematic, they're not being targeted in a systematic way. Local authorities don't always have up-to-date information about the local food environment. So we obtained, we being me, Tom Burgoyne, and others in my department, attained a small grant from the ESRC Impact Acceleration account to develop a new tool for public health, a web-based tool to provide up-to-date and accurate information on the local food environment at various levels of geography, intended for use in local planning and public health programming. So, this is just a screen grab of what the tool looks like when you bring it up. This is just showing, I've got it ticked right now for takeaways, showing you takeaways in counts across the counties of England. But you can adjust it. For example, you can adjust the expression of the counts standardized either by population or by the as a percentage of other food outlets. And when you do that, you get a very different picture. So suddenly, everything is red here, or most things are red, but suddenly when you do that, now expressing takeaways as a percentage of all food outlets, you see that the hotspots now start to become kind of up here and up here. And we can also zoom in. Let's zoom in to where we are, the east. And you can see also we're looking at different percentages of takeaway food outlets. And here we are in Cambridge, where we have about 27%, about one in four, if I can do the numbers, of our food outlets in our region are takeaway food outlets. We can zoom in even further. And now we're looking more specifically at our city. And the geography changes again. So where we just were looking at local authorities, now we're looking at LSOAs, which are administrative boundaries that are relevant for the census. And again, you can see that there's some variation. Some areas are hotter, some areas are cooler. But I think the more interesting way to look at this is when you start to compute takeaway food outlet exposure at the unitary postcode level. And in that case, you start to almost create a surface where you can see the spatial variation in the takeaway density normalized against all food outlets, and you can really start to see areas where you might have excess numbers of these types of food outlets. And this kind of tool perhaps might be important for using, for informing decisions, for example, at the local area. If we zoom in here in the north part of town, for example, asking the question, how is a local primary school doing with respect to the food environment? Are there too many takeaways there? And so this metric, I'm not going to get into the way we've computed these variables, but I'm happy to talk about them later. But the idea is that the ambition that we have is that this tool become freely available to people involved in planning and public health and be used to provide up-to-date information for their decisions. So just to recap, I've tried to show you that socioeconomic disadvantage is connected to unhealthy food environments. We know that that food environments in general have a measurable impact on diet and weight, and those environments might be particularly more important for people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. And I would argue that tackling unhealthy food environments is a population-level approach to deal with unhealthy diet and obesity, and in particular, it might help close inequalities, because if we move the number of takeaways to the left, our evidence suggests that this gap between lower and higher groups might begin to close. And that's it. And I just want to thank my colleagues, in particular Eva McGuire, who's here today, Tom Burgoyne, and Jasmine Morris, who's helped with developing FEET, and our funders. Thank you very much.